Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event, able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And John.
And, wait, John, did you scare everyone else away?
No.
I'm here.
I was gonna say, but we do have a very special guest with us this week. It's a friend of the show, artist extraordinaire, storyteller extraordinaire, an all-around great guy, Rusty Gilligan. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing really good. Now that you've renamed me, I probably make more money.
I've known him for years. I mean, criminy.
I'm getting to be very popular with the hip crowd now by saying, you know, it's kind of a Cthulhu thing.
Hey, yes. Rusty, I got a bone to pick with you, man. Dude,
it was one time in college, and that goat never pressed charges.
Besides that one, is it something about, like, on your birthday, all cats decide to try and kill podcasters you don't like? I had my cat jump out in front of me, land under my foot, and lay me out on the floor. And it was your birthday, man.
Wow.
I sense the hand of Rusty, or the paw of Rusty.
The paw of Rusty.
the ever-reaching. I'll tell you what's funny. I have 9 cats, and then we have an apartment that's adjacent to our house, so we have a couple of cats there. And it's like wireless radio, because the minute that you open the refrigerator, they're all there. I don't know what it is. It's like Star Trek teleporter, go. And they're like right at your feet. And I go to the apartment and I go to look through the door and they're all looking through me. It's like, I mean, looking through the glass at me. It's like Children of the Corn. I'm freaked out. Especially at night, because the tiniest little light bounces off their eyes,
right.
And it's literally like 10 little headlights sitting at the door looking at you.
Kitty of the corn. So, you're here for a reason this week, though. You have a very special project.
It can't be.
You have a very special project you'd like to talk about, don't you?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. Your $10 will go through PayPal now. I'm working on a comic book project. People mostly know me for the stuff that I've done or the Mac in Trouble comic book that I publish. I took a big break because I had a problem with a publisher who shall remain nameless because I don't like drama. But I had a bad problem with a publisher, and I decided to take a break, step back, and do something a little different. And the character that I created back in the 90s is a character called The Symbol, which is a patriotic character, and it has a sci-fi twist. And originally, it has a very interesting backstory, which I'll shorten greatly. I had created this character for Marvel back in the 90s when they had decided that they were going to do a relaunch of their Golden Age titles, which kind of prominently figures into this legacy nonsense that's coming up. They originally were going to bring back characters like the Angel and the original characters that they created with the Invaders and the Liberty Legion and on and on and on, Venus and whatever. And they wanted to bring some brand new created characters in. So The Symbol was created as a sci-fi adjunct. The story behind The Symbol was he is a Captain America type superhero that exists on an alternate Earth where the Nazis and the Axis powers are winning War II. And he takes part in an experiment to go to an alternate reality to rally heroes or rally support to help them win the war, and he gets stuck, and he bounces from reality to reality without being able to control it. And originally, the story was supposed to be he was to prominently figure into first the original appearances. They would be bringing back like homages of the panels. They'd be bringing back the homages of the covers and on and on and on. And he would be uniting all of these characters and then settle. But the project was pretty much doomed because they decided that they were going to go another way. So a couple of years later, I retained the rights and I kept it. And I didn't want to play around with them. Marvel's a great company, but when you think of Marvel, you think of Stan Lee, you think of the House of the Ideas, mm-hmm. you know, how Spider-Man and the Avengers and the Hulk and everybody was in the 60s and 70s. But it's a very different company when the 90s came along, and it became even more different, you know, in this century. And I just didn't want to be tangled up. I don't mind doing something for them, done other work for them, but I didn't want to be tangled right. up. So right. the character has gone through a couple of different incarnations. It appeared in the first ever multi-crossover comic book called Test Drive, which occurred in 1997. And then since then, it's appeared in special books from Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. Quantum Comics had put out something, and then they went out of business a couple of years later. So maybe he's a little jinxed. But there was a number of books that he appeared in, and this 64-page volume collects rarely seen, never before seen, unpublished stories, as well as a brand new origin and a brand new story. And it's going to start off a whole new series, a quarterly series of 64-page books from my studio. And there's some actually pretty cool names involved with the project, too. And we have an Indiegogo going on right now. And we're at about halfway with a month to go, which is good. I don't expect it to be thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. But we are increasing the project book nice. And the people behind it as we go along. So it's basically not just investing in a book. It's almost in like investing in the future of.
Right. I'm sorry. I had to look up Test Drive while you were talking. And so Rob Liefeld worked on that book too?
Rob Liefeld did one cover and then John Orlando did the other.
Yep.
Rich Buckler, who was a dear friend of mine, he just passed away a couple of months mm-hmm. back. He worked on it. Gil Kane, the legend from the Atom and Green Lantern, he had a story in there. And then there were a number of others, too. Some people from other industries, like the manga industry. Ben Dunn from Antarctic Press was in there. And one of the Battlestar Galactica writers, Mario Samadavia, when he was still alive, he was in there. And a number of others. It was really a multiple crossover book, but it was the first one that, you know, you've heard of Marvel and DC crossovers or mm-hmm. Batman and somebody, whatever. Batman's always crossing over with somebody. But this actually featured more than one company in the book. I think there were 13
oh, wow.
in the book. And it won awards from Diamond, and it won awards from Capital City, which was a distributor back then. And it sold fantastic. It really did.
And you can actually still buy it through mycomicshop.com. Yep. So,
as a matter of fact, we have original issues that are autographed as part of the reward system for the Indiegogo that we're.
Oh, cool!
And links to that will be in the description.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say. So yeah, we'll have a link to the Indiegogo in the description and. How much longer do you have on that?
I tried to make it easy.
I'm sorry.
I tried to make it easy and tried to come up with like a really cool address and blah, blah, blah. But if you go to Indiegogo and you just put in symbol, S-Y-M-B-O-L, it's literally one of the first that come up mm-hmm. and it's the only comic that comes up.
Right.
So that just, I think that makes it really easy. I can give you guys the address. It's no problem, but I think it comes up pretty fast. Like.
Right, right. And how much longer do you have on that?
Another month.
Okay.
It ends... I think it's October 8th or 9th, but we're going to be continuing the project after that. So once Indiegogo is the campaign is over, people can still take part. We're just going to have an online event.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it'll be in print and it'll be digital, and the digital copies will actually have one more story and one more pinup that you can't get in the print copies. And on the opposite hand, the print copies have variant covers and one story is a variant from the digital. So you can possibly collect both if you're a mind to, but we made it special so that if you're limited to just print or just wanting digital, you get a special copy.
Cool. So what made you decide to, you know, go back to this character and bring him back?
Well, I'd like to say a whole number of things. Like, you know, oh, this is my favorite character. It's obviously not. I'd like to say that this is, like, the best character in the world, but, you know, that's subjective. I think the great thing about this is that we're in such a tumultuous time right now. You know, we have problems with the president. We have problems with, you know, Nazis and blah, blah, blah. And all of the patriotic characters that we look at from the big companies all seem to have their flaws. Captain America is Hydra, you know, and all the things that go along with that. And Wonder Woman and all the shenanigans there and all the other things that are going on with these other characters. Mm-hmm. This was a true patriotic character. Like, I love red, white, and blue. Like, I'm very, you know, flag-oriented, USA-oriented. I love all that stuff. I was raised that way, and that's just the way I am, tried and true. And I thought that this was a cool idea to bring it back now. And the culmination of all these stories had some great names that worked on it. And I thought, you know, this is a great way to bring back some of these, you know, some of these tales. You know, some of them are short. There's one silent story in there that ends with literally just one word. And it's just phenomenal. But great people worked on it. And, you know, I it also brings about a new series for my studio, too. We're going to be producing a quarterly 64-page book where the Symbol adventures will continue. And then you'll also get to see Mac in Trouble, and then it'll be like a revolving door third store producing. And it'll be just like a Golden Age anthology title. Those were literally the grandfathers of the comics that we read today.
Right.
Can you imagine a 10-cent, you know, newsprint book that had 96 pages with characters like, you know, Tarzan, the Spirit, mm-hmm. big Western characters, John Carter Wars, Zorro, Captain Marvel, on and on and on, Dick Tracy. Those were like the legends of then. You know, you can't really get something like that now unless you want to fork over, you know, $18 for a graphic novel based on one guy.
Right. So, and then you did say that you keep hearkening back to the Golden Age of comics. First question is, does the story take place in modern time? And two, are you trying to tell it as a Golden Age type story?
Some of the stories take place during World War II. Oh,
okay.
One takes place prior to the experiment where he launches himself from the alternate reality into our reality.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them take place in World War II after, and then the newer story takes place in modern times.
Okay.
Because eventually, see, the theory behind alternate Earths, without getting heady and sounding like I'm smoking something funny, is time moves differently on different Earths.
Right.
So he could be in World War II, pop into another Earth where it's the 80s, pop into another Earth where it's the Western period, like the American West, or, you know, modern times. And I think that makes for an exciting story, because there are going to be some places where wearing a costume could be a problem, or the kind of costume be a problem, or the fact that he's never been seen before. And to balance this out, we actually have two publishers that I'm friends with, companies that I've worked with, that are going to be doing crossovers at the same time. So their main characters will be crossing over with the Symbol, and it'll just continue to show him hopping from one reality to another and then popping out.
Is that anything you can share now, or people need to wait and see?
John Helmer at Lucky Comics, who produces the Beetle Girl comic, and he also has Red Leaf Comics, where he has the Canadian character Red Leaf. We're doing a crossover with the Beetle Girl, and I can't mention the other title, but we will be crossing over with a company called Dojo Kun Comics. And understand, these might not be widely known, you know, very popular company names, but I like working with small press more than I like working with the major publishers. Right. I've worked for the major publishers, and I just don't like what they're spoon feeding everybody. So for me, a large paycheck isn't enough to sell out, you know, for all the time that I've been doing this. I've been doing this for 39 years. Mm. So I very much enjoy comics. When I was a kid, I would say, oh, I really want to work on Spider-Man. I really want to work on Batman. I really want to work on the Hulk. And those guys really impressed upon you that comics were real. I was a teenager and I would see Peter Parker in school and I'd be like, wow, I was the geek. And everybody took advantage of him, knocking the books out of his hands and trying to get a job, taking pictures for, you know, the Daily Bugle was like trying to be an artist, trying to break into Marvel or DC. Right. And I would see like the crisis that the mutants went through with the X-Men. Those were fantastic soap opera stories that had storytelling ability right down to the head. It's gone. And I don't see it coming back. They've tried so many times. Crisis on Infinite Earths, Crisis on whatever. Then there's Heroes Reborn. Then there's something else. Then there's, you know, diversity. Then there's multiversity. You know, it's just getting to the point where, you know, we took your last dollar. Now we need the lint in your pocket as well. So I'm just not a big fan of the big three or the big five or whatever they want to call themselves these days. And now that they're corporate, because they've been purchased by even larger conglomerates, it makes it a little worse because, you know, now we'll see, you know, Darth Mickey in the Avengers.
We could only hope for that.
And yeah, me too. And in a lenticular scratch and sniff version. So, you know, because we all need 100. We all need 100 covers with the same interior because they obviously want a discount with the printer. So can you print up 150,000 small, you know, small versions of the comic with new covers? And then, hey, we're all going to buy pizza. Can we all sit around and glue the covers on all weekend long? Whatever. Reminds me of the famous X-Men covers. First, it was four covers that made a, what was it, four covers that made a puzzle. Then it was all the cards glued. Then it was the hologram. Then it was lenticular. Then it was a baby version, which made no sense to me because, you know, X-babies or whatever the crap. And then it was, you know, they were all made of ice cream or something and melting. And then it was it just, you know, this is the Russian version. This is the Polish version, which started from the back up and down. And then it's whatever. You know, after a while, just make one good damn book. That's all it takes. Like, look at The Watchmen. You know, DC screwed more, but look at The Watchmen. The Watchmen is a fantastic one-time story. All the things that they've done after, the extra pages, the extra books, all the series and everything, rubbish. It was the one-time book was great. It didn't need 500 covers.
No.
It was, you know, but that the deal was, which a lot of people don't know, is that if they don't do something brand new with the project every year, the rights revert back to him. So they have to do, you know, they have to keep pulling rabbits out of their hat.
So that's six of one half dozen of another, though. I mean,
yeah.
On the one hand, you don't want them to screw it up like Fantastic Four. On the other hand, well, you don't want the rights to revert back to him. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
what's wrong with Alan Moore getting
personally,
the
Fantastic. If he got the rights back, he would bury it. That's the way I look at it. So if you're a fan and you haven't gone to the library, gone to Five Below and bought their version of the copy or whatever, you know, pretty soon it's going to be the, you know, the lickable purple haze version where it just comes on a slide. You lick it and sit back and you go through like a head trip. And
I think I saw that at Hot Topic.
Whatever. And it's got a musical soundtrack. But the you mentioned the Fantastic Four. That's a sore spot for me. When it comes to comics, because when even though the Avengers and the Fantastic Four, Justice League, all those characters that they created and multiple in and out revolving doors for characters, the Hulk is in, the Hulk is out, Cap is in, Cap is out, blah, blah, blah. Fantastic Four were a family. And I think that they should have given the Fantastic Four the kind of treatment that they gave Iron Man and Captain America, Thor, the Avengers movies. I have a feeling that if Marvel had started with the Fantastic Four and built upon that, there it might be a completely different cinematic universe.
Yeah, but I mean, they would have had to pay to get the rights back from Fox to do that.
Well, I don't think it would have been a bad investment. I really don't.
Yeah, I mean, then you know,
it's just like why Ant-Man and the Wasp or Giant Man and the Wasp weren't in the Avengers movie. I mean, you know, the Hulk was all CGI, and you know, all the aliens were guys with ping pong balls glued to leotards walking around until they added the green screen and the CGI in. What's the difference of making a guy grow and a girl shrink? It was like, was it the extra $1.50? Here, I'll fork it over and you can do it. So,
fantastic. Well, they had to reverse the polarity, that's all.
The camera needed batteries. Sorry, we can't do it. I like the idea of the Fantastic Four because it was a family, and they ruined it with the last Fantastic that they had. That was a travesty. Yeah.
Only the last one?
I thought the first one that they came out with, not the Corman one, obviously, but I thought that the first one that they came out with, where what was it? Ian Grufford was the Mr. Yeah. Fantastic. I actually liked that one. I really did. I actually thought it was good. I don't know about the most of the casting. And I didn't care for the Doctor Doom character, but I thought it was good. I thought it really showed family angst. I thought it showed family togetherness. I thought it made the person who was watching the go from being a viewer to a participant. I thought the storytelling was great. I just, you know, the follow-up was, it had shades of it, and obviously Galactus being a cloud was kind of a buzzkill, but I personally looked at him as being a rainbow, but that's different. But anyway, that's my thoughts. I'm my head is still back in the Silver Age and on and on and on. I don't really care for a lot of the newer stuff anymore.
Well, so speaking of the big two and the way comics used to be and whatnot, kind of curious to get your take on what DC has announced and the rumors around Marvel. What DC announced is that they're going to stop doing monthly books and just go to a prestige format for all their characters. Mm-hmm. And there's rumors that Marvel's going to stop publishing altogether and basically lease out the characters to other publishers to create books.
That sounds like a horrible idea.
Well, first of all, I personally don't believe the Marvel story 100%. Mm-hmm. That's BS to me. One of the problems with leasing out your characters to other publishers is the ability to control their use. Spider-Man going to start shooting webs out of his butt? What's the creative control? You know, is he going to move to Atlanta? You know, is he going to be like the new Clark Kent working, you know, the Daily Planet? Because let me tell you something, if they're going to lease them out, you know, the first couple of companies that are going to wind up getting them is DC, Image, Dark Horse, because no one's going to be able to. And for that high amount, it's not worth it. It's just not. They're not even pulling in the numbers that they report. Marvel sales are terrible across the board. So I don't believe that. I think this Marvel Legacy stuff coming up is a joke to begin with. I saw the video about a day before it came out, and it's kind of a joke. I saw the way that they had, you know, the famous Hulk cover with, you know, his reflection in Wolverine's claws, and then the homages, you know, Black Panther and, Ms. Marvel, and it's like a lenticular thing with the original Captain America cover, the origin issue. And, you know, it's just pandering. It's another way to make a couple of dollars. And, you know, all the special editions. I mean, when you look at a cover and they say they're going to letter them, you know, cover A is the first one, and then it goes all the way out to where cover L is like the sketch issue. You know, you're thinking to yourself, oh, my God, you're releasing like 18 covers of the same book. What the hell? You know, as for the DC. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's what killed a lot of people in the original back in the 90s. It was just, you tried to collect all the covers and all the crossovers, and you couldn't do it. And, I mean, that's when I lost it. I wound up paying, like, walking into a comic book shop one week and paying $147 for all the comics just so I could finish Armageddon.
Yeah.
At that point, it's like, well, I give up.
Yeah, it's nonsense. It is. I could understand putting out maybe three covers I really could. One cover, one that, you know, one is the master cover. One is a variant cover, which I think makes it more special. And if they're going to do a variant cover, they should do something in the book that's a little different. And maybe like add a, like in other words, have a master cover, and then that's your regular one. And then certain shops or certain ability to order from online places or whatever is the variant cover. And then maybe it has, for a dollar extra cover price or 50 cents extra, whatever, it has like a sketch gallery in the back or interview with photos or something. So that this way the book isn't just like, you know, some fish mm-hmm. wrapped in a different newspaper. It's actually got some meat to it and it's worth a dollar more. And then I think they should reduce the amount of sketch covers that they, because it used to be, you know, one or two. Now it's like almost every issue is a sketch cover or has one. And I think after a while, you know, the stable floor gets knee deep, you know, with this nonsense. As for the DC thing, I don't know. You know, it's DC kind of screwed the pooch with continuity years ago. They didn't realize they were doing it, but DC started out in the Brave and the Bold and Detective Comics. And these were like mm-hmm. the Jim Aparo years, like the 70s. And they would have, you didn't know if it was Earth 2 Batman. You didn't know if it was the 66 Batman. You didn't know what it was. Or sometimes they had what they called stylistic Batman, where it was a token adventure that didn't have anything to do with modern continuity. So you'd be watching it and you'd be like, you know, and you'd say, oh, this one is, you know, Batman and Plastic Man. But Plastic Man acted more like, you know, the Earth 2 version. This is Batman and, you know, Captain Marvel and or Shazam. And you know, he acts more like the Fawcett version. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Batman has to be Earth 2. And there were styles of the way they were drawn. You know, Aparo, Adams, a number of others had their own stylistic approaches. So, and then, you know, comics like Adventure, World's Finest, and a number of others would have these what-if type stories that preceded Elseworlds. They were like groundbreaking stories, you know, the son of Superman and the son of Batman, you know, and then you see the other ones like in the originals in wheelchairs. That's my boy. He's going to go out and beat Joker Jr., you know, and whatever. And, you know, what if Batman was raised by the, you know, what if, was it Bruce Wayne was raised by the Kents? What if Clark Kent was raised by the Waynes, you know, and they'd do mm-hmm. these stories. They had no continuity. They were just fantasy stories. But fun. Now it's, you know, Spider-Man is, you know, Peter Parker. Then he's not. Then he is. Then he's Ben Reilly. Then he's Miles Morales, you know, which I still don't understand because, you know, he's not even related to Spider-Man, calls himself Spider-Man, doesn't have the same powers, but knows Aunt May and knows Mary Jane and cries over it and blah, blah, blah. It's just, you know, after a while, Marvel and DC became costume right. shops. Whoever can fit into the costume can wear it for a while, you know, and it's not meant to dump on them because they did something right in the beginning. In the 70s, it used to be a bullpen rule that if a book wow. sold less than 120,000 copies, they would cancel it. I don't even want to think about what they sell today and why they aren't canceling or why they are. For example, Guardians of the Galaxy was their top, you know, top movie, I think, right. out of all of the franchise of Marvel movies. And two was, and they canceled Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
So.
Well, looks better on screen than it does in print, I guess, or the writing.
I think the problem is there are new fans, and you have to give them their due, because we were new fans. At least I know I'm older than you guys, but I was a new fan back in the late 60s. And when I read stuff like, you know, Captain America in, you know, Tales of Suspense, obviously I didn't read the original Golden Age because I wasn't even around then. So we were the upstarts. And there are kids that are growing up today with the Affleck Batman, where their parents might have been growing up with the Nolan Batman and their grandparents on and on and on back to Adam West. And this is their right. versions. This is their legacy is, you know, oh, I'm going to pass this Batman on to whatever. And then, you know, 100 years from now, it's going to be the holographic floating brain Batman, you know, and they're going to be, you know, they're going to be pushing that as the one. But these new fans are getting the same stories regurgitated with the new versions. And I just, I don't really see it as a benefit. If you want a new character, create one. They don't need to take a white character and turn it black, a male character and turn it female, all the diversity going on. And, you know, and this is the, they take a name and they tweak it so that it becomes the newer version. So, because I remember the Guardians of the Galaxy in the 60s, and they don't look anything like the one in the movie. So, but I don't know. It's, I don't want to talk. I mean, I've obviously talked it to death now, but I just feel bad sometimes because they don't really see the great storytelling. They're missing it. And Marvel and DC are both saying, oh, these were fantastic stories back in their day. They were, quote unquote, appropriate for their time.
Right.
And as we tear down Confederate statues and badmouth the president, the, you know, everybody else in the world and talk about war, we have to now get PC versions of all the characters, and we have to be clean with things, and we have to be shock jocks and scare to buying stuff. You know, Cap is a Hydra agent. Oh my God.
Well, that was a gimmick.
You know, the Falcon, Captain America, and all this other nonsense. And yeah. I don't know. After a while, it spoils the soup, you know?
This is true.
You got to admit, though, DC is giving it a college try with this rebirth thing. I've been trying to keep up with it, and it seems like they're bringing the stories back to, well, the stories rather than your, you know, monster of the week type, you know, story. They brought back all of the golden oldies. I mean, Superman, the original Superman is back that everybody loved. They brought back Hal Jordan. And, you know, they made it make sense. And they've added a twist with the Watchmen having to do with this whole problem and how everything's turning out. So,
yeah,
you know, I mean, I don't know how long you can milk that after the original stories are done and you've gone back to, well, we have these characters.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. You actually hit the nail right on the head, how long you could milk it. When these stories were happening in the 60s and 70s all the way up to the early 80s, they weren't thinking about milking it. They were thinking about storytelling. Mm. Then the summer events came along for Marvel and DC, and those were like, well, the kids are out for summer. They've got, you know, they need something to do. Let's cross over like six stories, and then the Avengers go into, you know, something gauntlet, something war, something secret, blah, blah, blah. And then there'd be like a couple of annuals that would mix together or whatever, Throne of Atlantis type stuff and on and on and on. It was all huge. And they'd take like Crisis, and like other books had Crisis little appearances in them, but they would spotlight like The Flash and on and on and on. Good storytelling. I mean, it wasn't properly done because Crisis was literally like, you know, buying a new litter box, filling it with, you know, the best stuff you could buy and then crapping on the front porch. But I mean, it was great storytelling. It sucked in the fans like as if they were watching television. Some fans actually said that they read the Crisis books more than once in the same week. Because they'd read another book and it would, a panel or a talk, you know, something of speech or whatever would bring them back, and they'd have to hearken back to that book and reread it to get a better grip or a better understanding of the total story. And that was the way comics used to be in the golden age. They were self-contained. There was no part one, part two, part three. It was good storytelling. It was gripping. The reason anthologies worked was because if you couldn't lure someone in with Dick Tracy Detective, you lured them in with, you know, Cowboy Bob. And if you couldn't do that, then it was Undersea Agent. It was, you know, Captain America, or it was, you know, the living zombie or something along those lines. And kids would read the books and trade them. And it became a giant, you know, comic books became a giant part of subculture.
Yeah.
You grew up with comics and your parents threw them out, you know. But today, it's like, it kind of reminds me of, well, you know, the death of Superman. So, you know, every lawyer, every doctor, every architect, you know, big professionals are spending hundreds of dollars on those sealed black bag, you know, Supermans. and thinking that, you know, someday they're going to be worth a fortune. And I went to a show recently in Vermont, the Vermont Comic Con, and one of the dealers had about 50 or 60 of them in the dollar bin. It literally looked like little trash bags lined up going out to war. It was like crap.
For me, I've got the Todd McFarlane Spider-Man number ones. But that, going back to something you said before, there was the platinum cover, the black cover, the ruby and sapphire cover, the black and white cover. I mean, there was like so many different covers of that one. And only a few of them actually, you know, worth more.
I find it funny.
I remember.
Worth more.
So. What'd you say?
I said, I find it funny when they say worth more. One's worth more than the other. I just had this discussion with a friend of mine who runs a popular mini show, I guess you could say, a small show in New Jersey. She runs about four or five shows a year. And I told her, we were talking about price guides. And I told her, I said, this is why, one of the reasons why Wizard and a couple of the other companies got in trouble with their price guides, because it was all graft. Whoever bought the most ads would get the cover, and then that month the books would go up, and then they would go down in the next issue, then they'd go back up again. The funny thing is, price guides and worth, if you want to say it that way, for collectability should really go up and down in value based on production numbers. Because it doesn't matter that, well, this was a beautiful cover done by Alex Ross if they go ahead and produce three times as many. That just means that it's three times less rare than the regular cover drawn by, Schmo and whatever. And I personally think that the books that are, in my opinion, worth the most should be the ones that were produced in the least amount of numbers. But price guides are jaded, and they're usually bogus. I tell people, if you're going to look at Overstreet Price Guide, the books are literally 30% less than what they produce in the book. If you're going to look at Non-Sports Update for cards, maybe 30 to 40% and various other price guides. Because if everybody at a show, all dealers, sold the books or the cards, the prices that they have in the guide, it's not a leveling system. If you can buy the same book for $15 at 12 tables right in a row, that's not helping the industry. That's hurting it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to me, I look at all the various covers, all the variants, all the sketches, all the gimmicks and whatever as really ruining the industry. Because once a fan spends $50 on just one book, what are they going to have left to spend on all the other books that they're missing out on?
Right. It's funny, going back to the black bag Death of Superman, I remember when it came out, I ran out and bought it. I brought it home, and my brother and one of our friends was there who was a big collector, but he was one of those, he collected because he thought they were going to be worth money, and I ripped the bag open in front of him, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I want to read the story. I want to see how they kill Superman off. Like, that's the whole point of this." And, like, he got mad at me, and I'm like, "That I read comics. That's why I collect them, to read them."
Right. That's what the internet's for. Well,
this is way before the internet.
You know, I worked on the, you guys have heard this story a million times, worked on the original heavy metal movie back in the 80s. We had no internet, no cell phone, no overnight shipping. We didn't have copy machines. You had to get Veloxes or prints made, which took a day sometimes. It was funny because if you wanted something to get there the same day, you had to buy an airline ticket and have it black bagged to somebody, airport to airport. And, there was no internet back then. The way that the collectors were, they were putting out fanzines. They were going to the early collectible club meetings, which began the comic bins. They were doing all these things that replaced the worth of the internet today. And I just don't see anything like that. And with, it's so easy to buy a scanner. You'd be Joe Schmo and buy a scanner and share a stolen book or a digital book. I don't know. I don't want to say that the internet ruined comics, but I think people utilized the internet and saw the potential, and it ruined.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
It's like my old coach used to say when I was wrestling. The first guy created a gun, and he went out and hunted, and he used it for protection. Second guy shot someone. First guy created a camera, took pictures of mountains and flowers and animals. Second guy shot naked pictures of his next-door neighbor's wife. You know, It's like one jerk comes along mm-hmm. and ruins the whole thing.
Yep. This is very true. So, all right. Well.
But anyway, I don't want to get off the subject, you know, so I apologize. I'm just very passionate when it comes to the state of the way comics are these days. This isn't a widely known story, and a lot of people disagree with it, but I remember hearing about it when it was live. Back in the late 90s, DC was going to make anthology mm-hmm. family titles. I think I told you about this once before. And it was kind of a secret thing, but now I just don't give a damn. But the thing was, is to do like a Batman family, like a graphic novel, like a trade paper, at, you know, that kind of thickness and girth to them. So there'd be like one main Batman story, then there might be a Robin story, then there might be a Batgirl story, and then there might be something else. And that was the way that they were going to publish. They were going to stop publishing individual titles and start publishing family titles. And for the ones that didn't have families, you know, outside the Batman, the Superman, the Justice League, all the others, they would do groupings like sci-fi right. title, monster title, mystic, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
That idea was canned because they felt that they were putting too much pressure on a consumer. Somebody who was interested in Batman and Detective would be paying, you know, $19 for a volume, and they might not want to spend $19 on the Superman, where they may, you know, psychologically be buying and paying more, mm-hmm. but they'd be buying the individual issues as a collectible. So I pushed that idea aside. To hear that they might stop publishing single issues, or floppies as they call it, and prestige or bigger format, kind of makes me feel like it's another bad idea that was canned, that was tested and failed. But let's try it again anyway, because we have, you know, we have no other option, you know.
Yeah.
Let's try and fly when we fell off the cliff, because obviously we misgrabbed.
Yes.
It's like the coyote, the roadrunner chases him off the cliff and he goes up a sign that says, whoops, and he falls into the cloud and hits the ground. That's the way I look at both companies right now. Unless they grow wings, and that'll be a new cover too, the winged version. You pull it out of the plastic, and two wings pop up and flies around. You got to chase it.
So DC's the coyote, and the consumer is Roadrunner. So,
well, in this case, I really feel like both companies are, and this isn't just aimed at just Marvel and DC. I actually kind of feel like that it's all companies are doing this now, all trying to do something.
Right.
You know, we have a campaign, we have, for the symbol, I'm not a big publisher and I don't want to be. I have no illusions of being a big publisher. I'm never going to be there. I don't have the funds for it. I publish because I like to see my stories in print. I like to get a couple of together and we chat around and we say, hey, let's do a book. And, you know, we have fun. It's dabbling. I work for other companies and I do film work. I'm happy with that. So I know I can only go as far up there as I can. We have a couple of variant covers for our campaign, but because of print on demand, you can get as little as one mm-hmm. copy. We're only printing those variant covers for people to take part in those rewards. So if you go up and you say, well, I want the Dan Gorman cover, or I want the Terry Pavlett cover, which are two of the covers we're doing, and you're the only one, well, then you're the only one who gets it, and it's done. Any books that we bring to the conventions, you know, to have on hand when a book is printed is just going to be the regular cover.
Right. Cool.
That's right, collectability. Exactly. To me, that's proper. And it will literally state in the cover on the indicia how many copies were printed.
Oh, cool. Yes. Well,
so
the big two should learn from you guys.
Well, I think the problem with the bigger companies is they marketed out their characters for merchandising very, very, very strongly. It's like you go out and find a billion different things with Batman mm-hmm. on. But in return, the books are not licensing, the companies are not licensing the characters to merchandise. Now their book is considered a part of merchandise, and they're in competition with
right.
Shadow. They're in competition with their own legacy. Because if you're a kid and you have $10, you could buy a couple of Batman comics, or you could buy a Batman shirt. You could buy Batman toys, action figures, whatever. You could buy a Batman game. and play it on whatever platform, you have the ability of, you know, celebrating Batman in whatever fashion you like. Even down to people who read the comics, who barely watch the movies, who are like, wow, Batman is cool. So they go out and they buy, like, a glow-in-the-dark keychain, or they get, like, a Batman bandana to wear, or they buy a Batman cape and put it on their dog for Halloween, those little animal costumes. But people celebrate these things right. in their own fashion. Well, the comics have become in competition, because when I was a kid, I watched Adam West and Burt Ward, and I loved that Batman series. I watched, even though it didn't last for very long, its series with Williams and Bruce Lee, I loved those. And I would go out and I'd buy the book. And then I would be like, wow, I love the book. I love the way the show is. It's like a cartoon, and on and on and on. And those shows were made to sell breakfast right. cereal and sell toys. That's the Saturday morning formula. But today, everything is in such competition and such flux that now writers write the comics because they want to see them be made into movies. So they write the scripts and do the artwork as mm-hmm. if they're working on it. And they don't realize that comic books have their own, separate from the movies have their own. Because I've done production art on a couple of these, and like Walking Dead and are based on the comics. And the way we do our storytelling, the production art, and the designs that we for like wardrobe, movie covers, and on and on and on, have absolutely nothing to do with the art and story for the books.
Right.
It's a different medium. So, I don't know. I just feel bad for the kids today. They're missing out on that great storytelling, which gave birth to what they've got now. It's like they're trying to water a dying vine.
Right. Well, I do think, since you just talked about the movies versus the comics, it's a great segue into our little bit of fun for the evening.
Wait, we have fun here?
I'm still waiting.
So this is something that we used to do with the audience, and we've done it live a couple times, and I want to bring it back, continue doing it on the show. And this is Stump the Geek. It's a trivia game. So I'm gonna. This is.
I'm not the geek, am I?
What was that?
I'm not the geek. Well, am I? I've been called worse. I mean, it would be an upgrade.
So this is Stump the Geek movie night. So all of these are movie related questions. And how it's gonna work is I'll ask each of you. I'll go back and forth asking you guys questions. If you get it right, you get 2 points. If you get it wrong, your opponent has the ability to steal for 1 point if they know the answer.
No.
You guys ready? And since Rusty, you are the guest, you get to go first.
Oh, man. I get to look like an ass first before he gets to look like an ass. That's not fair.
I'm gonna start with an easy one, I think. How's this?
How do you spell it?
In the first Iron Man movie from 2008, when Pepper walks in and catches Tony taking off the damaged armor, what object can you clearly see on his workbench?
Captain America's shield in progress.
Yes, there you go. 2 points. See? Easy.
And then I lose connection.
All right, John, now it's your turn.
Boy.
I'll pick another easy one to start off with you. Now here's a really easy one. You should get this one. The foot from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie is a parody of what other villainous group?
The Foot and Mouth Clan? No. The Foot in Mouth Clan? No. The Left Foot Clan? No. I got it. The Anti-Metrics Clan? No. It was the hand. Yes.
Okay. Since that was an easy one and we're warming up, I'll let that go. But the next time you shoot out a joke answer, it'll count against you.
Oh, come on. My jokes are worth at least twice what the real answer is. Okay. Maybe negative 2 points. I don't know. Go ahead.
All right. Here's Rusty's next question. It's a little bit harder. True or false, in the X-Men movie from 2000, both Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart didn't know how to play chess, when they were cast as Magneto and Professor X. So a chess expert was brought onto the set to help teach them how to play chess for the movie.
I'm going to have to guess. I'm going to say false.
No, sorry. It's true, actually.
Really?
Yes. I was shocked when I learned that, too. You know, you think they're both English. They grew up playing chess, right?
Well, I was thinking to myself that Stewart played Captain Picard. They were always playing chess or equivalent on Star Trek The Next Generation. So I thought it was a possibility, actually.
See? There you go. There's a point of confusion for a lot of people. They always picture Kirk and Spock playing chess in the original series. In The Next Generation, they were always playing cards.
You know what? You're right. There was a poker. Yep. There was a poker all the time, and it was Riker. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Now, John, here's another question for you. 2011, Thor. This was Natalie Portman's second comic book based movie. What was her first?
I mean, you could say Star Wars, because that did come out in comic book, and it's probably the wrong answer. I know I'm missing something obvious. Hey, wait a minute. How come he gets a true and false? And I've got to... Can you at least give me multiple choice?
Because he's the guest.
Fine. I'm going to see Star Wars. It did come out in comic book form a lot, but I'm pretty sure it's the wrong answer. Go ahead.
That is not the answer we're looking for.
I'll give you multiple choice. A is the right answer. B is the wrong answer.
Now, Rusty, you have an opportunity. Do you know the answer?
Yes, B for Vendetta.
Ah, there you go. Rusty has three.
I redeemed myself.
John has two. All right. One more question for Rusty here. This one's pretty difficult. So I'll give you a second to think about it after I ask. Cliff Robertson, who played Uncle Ben in the 2002 Spider-Man movie, is one of the few actors who has appeared in both Marvel and DC properties. What was the DC property that he was in?
It was
You mentioned it earlier when we were talking.
You expect me to know what I said? I don't recall. The only thing I could think of was one of the Superman films. That's the only thing I could think of.
You know, it's funny. I was testing these questions out at work, and one of my coworkers said the same thing. But no, he was actually in the 66 Batman TV show. He played Shane, the gunfighter.
Shane. See, I was thinking about movies. I wasn't thinking about TV.
Oh, okay. Hey.
I wouldn't have gotten it, but I mean, that was what I was thinking of, was the movies.
Dave, we're comic book guys, not archaeologists, okay? just try to keep them, like, you
but
know,
Rusty grew up
local
watch-
to our time zone.
Rusty grew up watching them, so I figured, you know, he might remember that.
Yeah. I know, but, you know, I grew up watching those too, and the mind grows a little weak.
All right, weak-minded.
Go for it.
Here's your question.
Hit me.
As we all know, there are a ton of Easter eggs in both the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. In 2015, James Gunn famously tweeted out that one of the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 Easter eggs has not been found as of that point. So, now that it's 2017, has that Easter egg been found? And if so, what is it?
Wait a minute. You're asking me to tell you what the Easter egg nobody's ever found is?
What kind of questions are these? I said James Gunn tweeted that in 2015. It's been 2 years.
I'm really feeling that the guest is having just a tiny bit of an advantage here. You know? Hey, Rusty, what color is George Washington's white horse? John, give me the 1,000,000th digit for pi. It's like, come on. I have no clue. I mean, there were so many, and what do I remember? Wait, let me think about this. I have no idea. I have no clue about them. Sorry. Let me take a guess. Nicolas Cage's Superman was in the background in the collector's collection?
No, not at all. Do you have any guess on this, Rusty?
You know, I remember somebody saying something about it, but I to tell you the truth, I don't know.
All right, guys. Well, it was a trick question. As of today, of recording this podcast, the final Easter egg has not been found in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1.
You and I are going to have some very unpleasant...
However, one of the my favorite YouTubers, who goes by the name Mastertainment, let that sink in, it's a joke. Okay. He does these videos where he postulates what the missing Easter egg is. And James Gunn, in an interview, or in a video that he posted last week, said, no one's found it yet, but MT, you're getting very close to it. So I would suggest people who are interested in this to check out his channel on YouTube. He's got a lot of cool videos.
MT, is his name MT Promises?
Something like that. All right. Well, I can declare Rusty the winner. I can ask one more question each. What do you guys say?
Well, you can do both.
All right. Let's see. Here's another. I got two more Batman questions here. In the dark, so this is for Rusty. In The Dark Knight, this is the only film where Batman does not use what?
Sorry.
That's why no sharks went to see the movie.
Throat lock. See, I would have guessed the
battering.
Yes. Ding, 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 ding. Oh, wow. You are correct.
I had a choice between that and the bat cycle was the other one I was thinking of, but I wasn't sure.
All right, and the last question for John. In the 89 Batman movie, Michael Keaton's opening line is, famous opening line as Batman is, I am Batman, when the villain asks, who are you? That line was actually ad-libbed by Michael Keaton. What was the original line in the script? I'll give you a hint. The line was made famous in the animated series.
But he said, I'm Batman.
Right, but what else does Kevin Conroy say?
Sign my paycheck here. Yeah, what else does I am the knight?
Holy yes,
see, kids, if all you right. watch enough cartoons when you're adults, you too can well win the mildly interesting game on a podcast.
So, with a score of 5-4, Rusty is the undisputed geek of the week.
I am the wiener.
He would have been the undisputed geek even if I had one myself. Because apparently he's got his cats watching me. I don't know.
Remember, they're the kitty of the corn.
Great. Yeah, I'll get some sleep tonight over that one.
All right. So I think we had a lot of fun. You have anything you want to add, Rusty, before we call it a night?
No, I'm just doing a bunch of work lately. I tell everybody... look me up on Facebook. I love talking to the fans, and I've been posting a lot of stuff. I've been doing a lot of voiceover, and I just got done, actually, voiceover. Well, soon to be released, there's an anime called Dagon, and it's a fantasy movie. It's really, it actually is very, very different, very reminiscent of Ohms. And then I have the book going on Indiegogo. Just go to Indiegogo and look up the word symbol, and you'll see it there. And that's about it. I'm working on trading cards. I'm doing a little Shop of Horror sketch cards right now for a company called Attic Cards. Cool. So, you know, I have a lot of different irons in the...
Cool. All right. And as we said earlier, he has his Indiegogo going on for the symbol. The link is in the description of the episode. So, you know, please go and donate and help this great project. We at Superhero Speak believe it's worth your time and effort. And
there are some really good rewards. We researched pretty heavily, and a lot of the rewards of stuff that you've never seen before.
Oh, okay. a good DC comic? a good DC movie.
No, I don't have a time machine to go back to the 60s. Aww. Sorry.
So then on that note, boys and girls, as always, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.